Hey friends, thanks for tuning in to the Book Spider podcast, a nifty program that covers literature of all kinds, sometimes music, sometimes aesthetics, and sometimes cultural criticism. This episode, the three hosts, Chris Malmberg, Hans Berger, and myself, Patrick Barney, are going to discuss The Left Hand of Darkness, a famous sci-fi novel by Ursula K. Le Guin. The Left Hand of Darkness tells the story of Genli Ai, an envoy to the wintry world of Gethin, and Estravan, a disgraced prime minister from the Gethin nation of Korhide. Genli approaches the king of Korhide, hoping to get Gethin to join the Ecumen, an anarchist association of 80 or so planets, but the king is stupid and fearful, and ultimately banishes his prime minister, Estravan, for supporting Genli. Estravan escapes to the neighboring nation of Augurain, and Augurain has more of a bureaucratic rather than monarchical organization. On his own, Genli decides to travel to a place called the Fastness, where he gets a prophecy that Gethin will in fact join the Ecumen, and then he moves on to Augurain to seek more friendly alliances there. However, Genli faces danger from the Sarf, which are kind of a secret police that run everything. He faces danger without being aware of it and is kidnapped and taken to prison. Estravan learns of Genli's imprisonment and helps him escape, which requires crossing about 800 miles of glacial plateau. During the escape, Genli and Estravan become great friends, and Genli learns that Estravan has been the only supporter of Genli's quest to get Gethin to join the Ecumen. The pair do make the glacial crossing from Augurain back into Korhide, but when Estravan tries to get back into Augurain, he is spotted by guards and killed. However, Genli is then able to convince the king of Korhide to join the Ecumen, so Estravan's saving Genli is not in vain. Some good things happen, I guess, if joining the Ecumen is a good thing. And oh yeah, all the people on Gethin are intersex people. For 24 days of their 26-day month, they are all androgynous. But then for 2 days each month, they go through what's called Kemmer, which is when they're looking to bone, and
perverts.
that's what some people call them. When they're in Kemmer, they're perverts. When they're not in Kemmer, their latent cycle is called summer. So during Kemmer, their sex organs, which are not really there, will engorge, and another's will kind of morph into a receptor, and they go at it. And there's no rhyme or reason. Like, one time a Gethin could take on the male role where the organs engorge like an erection, but in the next time, the next Kemmer, they could the organs could morph into a receptor like a vagina. So there's no rhyme or reason. It can just happen either way. So I'm interested in talking about one thing I want to talk about definitely is how this biology features as a political theme in the novel and how it's related to the some of the anarchist stuff. But first, I wanted to monologue for a bit, and I hope you guys don't get too disappointed. I don't want to take too long, but there are some things I feel like I have to say.
I mean, I'd be a hypocrite if I were to complain about that, wouldn't I?
Right. That's what I was thinking. I was like, well, Hans does it sometimes. I can do it too, right?
Yeah, man, the stage is yours, Patrick. Fucking seize it.
All right. So, interestingly, I hadn't actually planned on picking this book, the Left Hand of Darkness. When we were discussing last time, when we were discussing Bleak House, the pick that I actually had in my mind was another Le Guin novel, The Dispossessed, which is about a planet with a moon. And on the planet, they have a capitalist economic system. And on the moon, they have an anarchist economic system. And like, so it's like how the politics between the two plays out. So I wanted to pick that, but for whatever reason, my brain farted when you asked me, Hans, what my pick was, and I said The Left Hand of Darkness, and then Chris was like, oh, that's a good book. And then I was like, oh, shit, I guess I can't take it back. So that's kind of why we ended up reading The Left Hand of Darkness instead of The Dispossessed, which I'll probably end up picking at some point in the future. So that's just a little backstory, but what I really want to kind of monologue about for a little bit is genre. So I know this may not be as interesting to you guys, but I do really dig a nice ontological question, like what is genre or what is literature? I assume that these are meaningful questions and that we can make progress towards answering them. So I like to give them a go. Last episode that I said something like I don't believe in genre, and I kind of wanted to clarify my position on that. I don't know that I would do this monologue if I hadn't said that last time, but I just wanted to make this clear. I definitely think that genre exists. Like, obviously, when you go to a bookstore, there are books that are in the horror section and books in the thriller section and books in the literature section. So we're obviously putting some books in certain genres and other books in other genres. I think if I had been able to say what I meant more clearly when we were talking last time, I would have said that I dislike the dichotomy that we sometimes construct, which is that genre books are bad and literary books are good. I think the main reason that dichotomy doesn't work is that there aren't really any necessary conditions for calling a certain book a genre book and another book a literary book. There are all sorts of literary books that do things we would typically associate with genre. You know, like world building is an example. Just on this podcast, if I just confine myself to talking about things on this podcast, books like Waterland, Bleak House, the Southern Reach series, Lapvona, those are all like literary books, but they're all doing world building. You know, other literary books do things like speculative apocalyptic stuff, like The Road, The Handmaid's Tale doing dystopian stuff, Gilead doing historical fiction stuff. So you're going to find those books in the literature section of the bookstore, but they're doing things that genre books do too. So that to me seems like just the plain facts. Like, some things we call literary and other things we call genre, even though I'm not sure what kind of distinction there actually is between them, other than this idea that literary books are good and genre books are bad. But we wouldn't do that. We wouldn't make that distinction when we're talking about music, right? Like, this is a directly analogous category where we don't separate music between genre and good, right? Music can go into different genres, but within the genre, it's good or bad, you know? Opeth is a progressive metal band And I don't necessarily like progressive metal or progressive anything in general, but I know that they're good. Like, they're a good band, like a fantastic band. So I kind of feel like I just wanted to get that off my chest, this little thing about genre and literary. And really, I think it kind of keeps us for thinking about whether a book is good or not when we differentiate between genre and literary. You know, a good book. Whoa, what was that?
My chair? I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
It might have been Hans's chair. Yeah.
It was super loud, and it scared me.
Is that the sound that you were being bothered by?
Yeah, that is the sound.
It's horrible. All right, let me do an edit point.
Bring the drum mic back, Hans.
You guys are just hearing it through my phone like you always did. There's no change to...
Well, that's true. That's true. That's right.
I had it muted for quite a while because I was typing while Patrick was talking. But
right.
So it's been...
Basically... All I'm really getting at is that I think we should pay attention to like what makes a book good, like freshness of language, complexity of theme, plot structure, and so on. So before we go directly to talk about The Left Hand of Darkness, did you guys want to add anything to my monologue? You want to disagree or
Is that called a glomologue?
Yeah. What's the GL stand for?
To glom, you know, to glom onto something. We're glomologuing onto your monologue.
Yeah. Do you have anything to glomologue?
I mean, I think I was going to ask you a question, which is probably after you just finished talking and asked us to talk. But like, if you're saying that if you took the valuative out of the dichotomy of genre, or are you saying the dichotomy itself between genre and literary, is it the valuative nature of it, or is it something more fundamental, the dichotomy itself? Like, do you distinguish between literary and genre, but don't necessarily apply a valuative, like,
I don't think we should distinguish between literary and genre. I think that we should distinguish between good and bad.
Well, I guess, like, there's you don't think that there is like a spectrum that distinguishes between books that are written.
Or maybe I should say, I think we should distinguish between genre in the same way we distinguish between genre with music. Like, we'll put certain bands in genres in music, but we don't necessarily... Putting them in a genre doesn't mean that they're good or bad. Whereas in literature... The word genre often comes with that connotation that because it's genre, it's therefore worse than what we call literature or what we call literary, which is not necessarily true. I mean, certainly it's true often. You know, there are all kinds of trash genre books.
I think, like, the very first podcast that we did, this was the topic, right? Literary versus genre.
Oh yeah, it's. I know you guys don't care about it, but it's super interesting to me.
There are a lot of different lenses you can bring to it, I guess. Right? When I was reading your question, I remember thinking it was a little bit like race in people, right? Like the boundaries between you can draw any racial delineation and find people with a spectrum of qualities across those delineations, right?
Right.
It's a spectrum that we pretend is a binary, right? Or a trinary, or
right,
however many
right.
races you want to decide there are, which is made up,
right?
Right,
right, right.
And,
right, exactly.
You know, there's an assumed kind of, for much of history, right, there was like kind of white as a default and this sort of like assumed hierarchy in which like white just kind of was person and then everything else was kind of this additive quality, right? And
right.
You know, so, and to some extent, right, like you can't really eliminate these concepts from culture, but you can understand the ways in which the hierarchies that they impose are needless, right? That's one
right.
thought that I had.
Absolutely.
And, you know, for what it's worth, I mostly read literature and don't pay a lot of attention to a lot of genre stuff. But I do think that, like, another point that I suppose you could make, and that I've heard people like, I think Michael Chabon made this, if I'm remembering right, like, in some ways, like, literature is, in fact, like, literary fiction is a genre, right? In the sense that it is a marketing category with a certain set
right,
of expectations.
Right.
And so, I don't know, you know, in that sense, the category of literary fiction is sort of like it is, in fact, another genre rather than a thing that is distinct from genre in the practice of how it works in the world at large. And there might be more prestige attached to it, but there's varying levels of prestige within different genres too, right? Like science fiction, I think, is more prestigious in sort of a general cultural way than romance, right? So it's I don't know if it's so much a distinct category anymore as another of many genres with its own kind of distinct set of that just kind of lives within the hierarchies and has its own set of expectations. And I mean, I think for what it's worth, like, I don't, having been in an MFA program, I don't think I knew anybody in the program that was particularly contemptuous of genre, right? Like, everybody I was in the program with had a certain amount of genre fiction that they were fond of. Maybe not from every genre, right? Again, I don't know anybody who admitted
right.
to reading romance novels other than, you know, maybe one or two people who would admit to liking Twilight as a guilty pleasure, right? And,
sure.
You know, I mean, I think Twilight being a guilty pleasure because it is badly written, not because of the question of genre necessarily.
Right, exactly. You
know? I guess the third thing I would offer, and none of these really build on each other, just kind of tossing out thoughts I had when I was reading the printed version of your monologue to prepare for the podcast. I suppose the argument that I had when I was in, the argument that I had around this, that I read around this when I was in undergrad, when I think the hierarchy was somewhat more respected than it was even a few years later when I went through grad school. The way it was explained in undergrad was that with genre, the writer is setting out to deliberately meet a set of formulae for the benefit of a reader who expects to have a formula, to have boxes checked, right? That for commercial reasons, the genre writer is attempting to satisfy conventions in a pretty naked, obvious way, right? Whereas the literary writer is attempting to create something which is distinct enough in form, style, that the reader has to kind of learn what it's doing in the course of reading it, right? So that in some way, like, there's, you know, the second read is always going to be the better one because you are learning what the thing is doing in the moment that you're encountering it, right? Now, a very, very tiny percentage of literary fiction achieves that, but I suppose there's some, you could, the rationale that I had then was that there is some virtue in that attempt, right? And in some ways, I think the genre fiction, or the things that have an aspect of genre that you pointed to as having achieved the realm of literature, or, you know, been admitted to the halls of literature by the snobs, like Jeff Vandermeer, Philip K. Dick, Ursula Le Guin, you know, those are all folks who whether either, you know, deliberately or I think in some cases kind of accidentally, in the case of somebody like Dick, who was a maniac. I love Philip K. Dick, but he was, you know, a drug-addled maniac.
Sure.
Have, rather than, you know, rather than set out to fulfill a set of conventions in a deliberate way, have kind of accidentally done something very distinct in form that do require that kind of what the fuck am I grappling with, at least with the first one, right? And that can be just, you know, Philip K. Dick, he has a Philip K. Dick formula, but it's distinct to something he created. And the first few that you read, you know, Murakami is the same way, right? Like, the be sure that you read a good Murakami first, because the diminishing returns are quite intense after that. So I think that the,
right,
you know, when we, I do think that there's, I basically agree with what you're saying, and I like and respect lots of literary fiction, and I do recognize there's lots of literary fiction that is in its own way formulaic, especially now, maybe more so than 20 years ago, or maybe that's false, but I feel like I run into a lot more of what feels to me like formulaic literary fiction, right? That kind of is trying to do a particular thing to satisfy the expectations of a particular audience.
Right.
All that being said, I do also think that the hierarchy still enshrines a certain kind of distinction in approach and method and goal that shouldn't be totally let go of, even if I understand kind of their urge to, you know, champion things that feel disrespected.
I think I disagree with that last one. I think that, like, most of what you're saying, I totally, I'm on board with, like, the idea that literary fiction has become its own genre in a way, that oftentimes genre works are meant to follow a formula to achieve certain commercial ends. But I'm not quite sure I'm willing to, like, say that there needs to be a certain, like we need to think of the literary genre as the best genre or the genre with the most clout. I'm not sure. It just seems to me that if we were to, you know, if we were to do that, then what we end up doing is taking novels that really do belong to genre, that really do have total genre elements, and then just arbitrarily saying that they're literary because they have fresher language, or because they have more complex plots, or you know, they're doing something else that is formalistically interesting. And I guess I just don't quite see why we would do that, especially when we don't do that with music.
I think music is, in a way, like...
Can I jump in? Because I was
absolutely
thinking about this.
No!
Well, so music doesn't have a nearness to the way in which we communicate with ourselves and each other to convey meaning. I guess a simpler way to say it is that music is always abstract. So, you know, and I think that makes it sort of divorces it from the same. It takes some dimensions of evaluation away, right? So storytelling has a dimension or multiple dimensions that are created by its nearness to, like, lived experience, or you know, one would be like, how true was this really? You know, like, how biographically, mm-hmm, like, accurate was this, or how scientifically accurate even? Music doesn't have those. And so I think that it's almost like a vector math vector problem or a taxonomy problem, because like, I think actually literary as its own genre doesn't quite convey the fact that if you were to sort of, I don't think that this quite works, but if you were to sort of take an XY axis and say that on that two-dimensional quadrant, you could sort of map all genres, literary would almost be a Z axis, right? Literary would be representative of like the graph exploding in the third dimension to kind of to capture, you know, something else. Is it like more true to like our, I guess like, is the simplest way to think this maybe, is it poetic or not? You know, and I know that that's not adequate, but it does feel like music is a bit of a misleading comparison because it doesn't have that dimension that we assess it for. How, again, poetic is inadequate, but that's what I think of when I think of like literary. It's at least aspiring to a kind of higher something. And go ahead, Hans.
I think actually, and to the music point, I think that it's maybe wrong to say that music doesn't have a version of that, right? Because like, I think music, the changes that we're thinking about maybe happened on a different time frame, but like symphonic music kind of is the literary fiction of music, right? And I think that in, you know, the 1910s, the 1920s, I think actually the idea that, you know, like symphonic music functioned a lot like literary fiction did in our undergrad programs in the late 90s, and something like jazz, folk, like those were genres in a way that symphonic music, or I'm not calling it classical music because technically that's a period of it, right? But the tradition that starts with Baroque and ends with Romantic, and then that extends into like contemporary quote unquote classical music, like Arvo Pärt or something like that, or John Cage. Like that stuff, I think, is functionally the literary fiction of music. And there's not, I mean, even the term classical, like that is a, that's not so much a genre descriptor as just like a statement of the place of that thing in the universe, right? And I think through like, in the same way that like pretty much all fiction, I don't know, like it, I do think that there's a version of that around classical music. I think that the kind of the hierarchy that you're talking about was abandoned a long time ago, right? Maybe like 100 years
right.
ago. Right. But whenever it was that we started to, whenever it was that, you know, we started to treat something like jazz as being of appropriate, of equivalent prestige to symphonic music. But
so the analogy holds because.
We moved past that. Yeah.
And we should move past it for literature.
Well, it's more like what I was talking about, where literary fiction has become a genre in the same way that classical became a genre. Like, those mirror each other. I mean, I do think that, like, classical music in practice is, in fact, it's denser and richer and more harmonically complex. I say this as somebody who doesn't listen to much classical music, but it is in fact, in by most objective measures, probably like smarter, more, it's richer, you know? I mean, I guess like the point I was making earlier wasn't so much that we need to continue acting like whatever we designate as literary fiction is inherently better, right? Like I certainly think that, you know, oh, I don't know. Who's a literary author that I have disliked on this podcast? Ian McEwan, right? Like, I think Left Hand of Darkness. Mm. I probably think Ursula Le Guin is in some sense a better writer than Ian McEwan. Maybe that's not a good example because I was actually like, objectively, I think Atonement is a very, you know, objectively good book. I just personally didn't like it. But like, I don't know. Right. Who have I talked shit about? Joseph McElroy, right? The Lookout Cartridge. Like, clearly this is, essentially any reasonable person would say this is a better book than Lookout Cartridge. But I do think that I think the point I was trying to make more is that the impulse to elevate literary fiction comes from a respect for a certain set of ambitions. And I hope that leveling the kind of that I would agree to some extent with leveling the hierarchy between the genres, but I don't want that to come with a dismissal of that kind of ambition, right? Or the
I absolutely agree with that.
Okay,
we should be writing ambitious fiction, 100%. Even if what I'm saying is we should abandon this idea that literary means better.
I think that there's
definitely
like,
agree that we should.
Well, it's hard for me to really back this thought up, the next thought up, because I don't have, I haven't read every book, right? But I mean, I do think that like sure. within the genres,
who has?
because the definitions of the genres often allow more space for formulaic writing to satisfy, like there's kind of like an honor that's given to formulaic, particularly, I mean, in some genres more than others, right? But like in a lot of genres, there's an honor that's given to like formulaic writing to satisfy an audience that I think is, at least in theory, not given in literary fiction, right? Like if I think about because I used to read a lot of genre when I was, you know, a teenager, right? I read a lot of mystery. I read
sure.
a lot of, you know, lowbrow sci-fi. I read a lot of, well, mostly mysteries and bad sci-fi. But like, I have happened to encounter a lot more, like of all the literary books that I've read, I have an appreciation for a higher percentage of those than all the sci-fi that I've read. My instinct is to think that if you take 100 romance novels and 100 sci-fi novels and 100 fantasy novels and 100 literary fiction novels, and let's say that you choose the ones, I don't know, just that are most read in a year, right? That you're going to find a higher percentage of writing that shows a set of values and priorities that I appreciate. You're going to find a higher percentage of that in literary, in your 100 most read literary fiction books than you are in your 100 most read romance or fantasy or sci-fi books, right? That while it is true that all of those genres may have examples that involve creative plotting or stylistic unpredictability or well-crafted language, that the incidence of those is significantly higher in literary fiction because the attempt to achieve those is core to the goals of writers of most people who write in that admittedly a genre, you know? And I'm being somewhat provocative in saying that. I don't really, you know, I don't know if I have the knowledge to back it up. You're at least in the realm of sci-fi and maybe fantasy. You're much.
I don't know, but let's kind of shift gears. Like I think we covered this idea. Like there's some overlap in all of our positions, and that's good. You know, even if things aren't, you know, even if we don't totally see eye to eye on everything. But one thing you did say, Hans, that I wanted to circle back to, which was that like I take it you liked this, you enjoyed this book more than Atonement.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I had baggage with Atonement, right? It's kind of a hard comparison to make.
Right.
And to some extent, you know, like for complicated personal reasons, I approached this with a certain amount of reverence and optimism, and I approached Atonement sort of like walking into a porta potty.
The opposite.
After, you know, your buddy just tore it up, but.
Took it right. and that's something that like I wanted to ask, you know, after this long diatribe about how I think that like abandoning the hierarchy between literary and genre is probably the correct move, even if I agree with you, Hans, that we should That doesn't mean I think we should abandon ambitious literature. We should definitely not do that. I definitely want us to keep writing ambitious literature. But after this long diatribe or monologue, I want to know, like, is this book worthwhile? Like, what would we, on a scale of 1 to 100, with 100 being something really great, like Macbeth, and 1 being something absolutely terrible, like an unedited self-published Kindle book, you know, where would The Left Hand of Darkness go on that scale? And where would Atonement go? I'd put it higher than you guys. But to all the people who have been wringing their hands, can we please just talk about The Left Hand of Darkness? Now we're going to do it.
This whole time I've been trying to figure out how to make a joke where the punchline was the left hand of fartness, but I couldn't come up with it.
I think we know the title of the podcast episode.
Yeah.
The Left Hand of Fartness. Yeah.
Yes.
I could do that. It might scare some listeners away because they'd be like, what? I like that book.
Maybe we get a lot of listeners who really like farts, though. No, podcasts about farts.
But who doesn't like farts? They feel they're relieving.
Yeah, they're pretty great. I think that this is, this is a very 1 to 100 is pretty granular for springing this on us.
But, I really wanted it to be granular, and I didn't spring it on you. I gave you these questions days ago.
I guess that's true. I didn't think about the 1 to 100. I put like 70 for 70? Left Hand of Darkness. Yeah.
Okay.
And you asked about Atonement. I'd do 50.
Yeah.
50 on 50? Atonement.
How about you, Hans?
Oh, maybe like, you know, there's a difference between like how much am I personally fond of it and how much am I like recognizing that it has qualities objectively, reasonably objectively definable qualities that I think are admirable in fiction, right? By the objective...
Yeah, rate it on how good you think it is. Objectively, how good you think it is.
Oh, probably like, I don't know, like a 90. It's a very well-written book. Very well-conceived, very well-written. It has a quality where it can be appreciated at a relatively shallow read as an adventure story, but has... Right. Pretty good thematic depth in fairly subtle ways if you wish to tease those out. It's genuinely suspenseful. The characters have interesting complexity and shades. It has the sensuality of it is so rich, right? Like the snowiness of the planet. It's a very, very good book. I don't know that I love it in the way that I love, you know, my cat or something, but its reputation is well deserved, I think.
All right, yeah. So solid book, has some fresh language, has good themes, nice adventure story for the like top level to be interested in, but you know has a lot of stuff going on under the hood. Okay, and where do you rate Atonement, Hans?
In terms of, again, how I recognize objectively, I think I said during the Atonement podcast a number of times, probably almost too many for listeners at home, that I recognize that objectively it's a very well done book, right? Again, like a 85 or a 90, right? Like it's objectively a very, very good book. Personal affection, maybe like a 20.
Right, sure. I think, let's see. Like a personal affection for The Left Hand of Darkness and objectivity. Objectivity, I'm going to go with you, Hans. Objectively, I think it's solid, has plenty of good qualities, so like 85 to 90. How much I enjoyed it, maybe like a 67 or a 65.
Oh man,
I did.
That's lower than
yeah. Me. Yeah, well, like I said at the beginning, I didn't actually mean to pick this book. Like, I remember this was the first Le Guin novel I read, and I kind of bounced off of it. I remember liking the escape from prison section where they become friends, but kind of being a bit. Well, like before that, kind of bouncing off. And then, you know, I had meant to pick The Dispossessed, but I accidentally picked this instead. And in retrospect, I did find like the political machinations more interesting and the world building more interesting. But I think for me, for my personal enjoyment, the problem was I didn't know what the emotional core of the novel was until we get into that last part where Genly and Estravan become friends. And like, I really liked their bonding there. And, you know, that was something that I found very enjoyable, like just as like an emotional, like I said, core of the novel. But before that, like the first time I read it, I was kind of looking for some emotional core to latch onto, and it felt like it came too late, for my tastes.
I think that kind of makes sense, actually. We really hit the ground running in the novel. Like, Genly and Estravan's relationship is already strained, you know, by their very first conversation, by the time we experience the very first conversation in the book. And, you know, it does feel a bit, actually, for how meditative the novel is, it just kind of moves forward and it sort of is long segment of time we spend with Estravan and Genly, trekking through the snow together, that the book pauses long enough for it to kind of coalesce. I think that's right, but I really like that about it. It feels like it kind of I don't know. It I think that is probably the scene that there's probably the stretch that most readers would remember about this novel. And
right.
I think it's really earned and moving.
I agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. And
definitely.
And I think that it's, you know, kind of key and very, very subtle way to kind of like bring the narrative tension and the thematic tension together by making Estravan and Genly almost lovers, like we're right. Kind of right there, but not. And I think that's just a very incredibly subtle thing. But I totally get what you're saying. It does feel a bit like the book just moves in a way that is maybe actually, like Han suggested, really good at pulling in a lot of different people, because this is a very successful book for how right. subtle it is. And, right. and I think that that's maybe that has something to do with it.
And I will admit, I guess that personally, like I didn't follow, you know, the political machinations in the first, maybe third to half of the book. I wouldn't say I was following those that closely, frankly.
Right. Right.
Which,
yeah, I didn't.
So you think probably
wouldn't pass a test,
right?
You wouldn't pass the test if we were quizzing you on I'm going to say it wrong. Sorry, I was being cheeky anyway. Sorry, Hans.
Well, there might be a thematic point there, right? That like the narrator is also not following those things, that those are on some level all going above his head. And it would be interesting to reread it with the whole thing in view and see if that material resonated more, right? there's enough interesting detail and enough clever dialogue, enough good description that I could kind of just ride through it. I wasn't sure how much that would bite me in the ass. Not, it turns out, right? Like, you can read and appreciate and understand the novel well enough without it. You, Patrick, brought up the point of how much it makes a point about the political structure of these two kingdoms. And I think on a first read, that's completely opaque to me. I have absolutely no thoughts at all on that matter. Right. It might be that rereading,
well, you at least
knowing the whole structure, knowing the arcs, and trying to pick that out, it would be doable. But I got zip in that regard, which I think is partly, you know.
The political stuff I definitely didn't understand as much the first time I read it. I think it was 2019, 2020, so 5 or 6 years ago. And then on a second read through, when I first read this, I was just kind of starting to understand, like, that certain things about my own political perspective that made me start to think of myself as closer to anarchism than, you know, the Stalinist, Maoist bullshit that's authoritarian. So I didn't quite, because I was starting my journey, I didn't quite catch how Genli describes the Ecumen as kind of just an association of planets that kind of coordinate with one another and try to resolve disputes, but doesn't necessarily have laws or kings or anything like that. You know, and that's way more anarchistic, which I didn't get on the first read. And on that note, if you didn't quite catch all this stuff, Hans, maybe this isn't a good question, but I wrote it down, so I'll ask it anyway. And we're on that subject, but you know. Did you guys view the Ecumen as positive? Like, did you feel like, man, Gethin really needs to hook up with these Ecumen dudes? Because these monarchies and bureaucracies they got going on aren't that great. Like, was that something you caught? Like, did the Ecumen seem positive? You know, what do you think?
I mean, my own main sense of the stakes of them joining the Ecumen, and again, I'm sure there's a lot that I missed, but it's mainly talked about in terms of, that I can recall, it's mainly thought of in terms of being something that has the inevitable effect of unifying the planet, right? Initially, maybe one nation or state joins the Ecumen, but it creates the need to think and operate as a planet, as a kind of planetary group, which will inevitably result in, if I was understanding the implications right, kind of results in like a planetary government over that planet.
Right.
It has the effect actually of again, like there's many details I might be glossing over here, but as it's described, it seems like joining the Ecumen would in fact have the result of you could see it in a positive light as being unifying force, or I suppose you could see it in a negative light as being something that homogenizes everybody under one structure of authority. Inevitably, right? I think like most thinking in the realm of earthbound politics, right? Like most, I assume that most people who think of themselves as at least libertarian would describe a world government, like that's kind of the nightmare, right? So if the goal is the greatest level of autonomy possible based on decentralized authority, then something that results in a world government is kind of, I mean, maybe it miraculously creates a world government, governed according to anarchist principles, but there's no reason to assume that it would, right? That it would be that it wouldn't be more, that it would be more like a Karhide government over the whole world and less like, I don't remember, the more fascist authoritarian state.
Augurain?
Yeah, exactly. So...
Right. Well, either one of those seems like monarchy or authoritarian bureaucracy seems bad either way, right? Like, we don't want...
I don't want either of those things, you know?
Right, I mean, exactly.
My sense is
nobody...
that Karhide is... Like, Karhide is monarchical, but it's like a very loose monarchy over a kind of a number of somewhat autonomous nation states. Well, maybe nation states.
Right.
Somewhat autonomous groups with a kind of light monarchy holding them together. But, I mean, that's, you know, we had that in Europe for, you know, thousands of years, and it mostly was pretty nasty, as I understand.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, feudalism, not something I want to experience personally. I wonder if Le Guin specifically sets up a feudal monarchy next to a authoritarian bureaucracy like you would have seen in the Soviet Union or China. At least that's what I think she's going for. I assume she set these up as a way to critique both, especially since anarchists do critique both, right? Yeah. So maybe, like, if the Ecumen were to create a, like, the fact of joining the Ecumen creates a world government on Gethin. I assume Le Guin would think that's not that great because anarchists don't necessarily want a centralized authority. But maybe that's like a flaw in the novel then, if like the things that she's trying to critique and think about would kind of cohere even under the Ecumen. I'm not sure. Granted, that's, you know, this is like a quasi-aesthetic, quasi-political question that maybe we're not in a position to answer. I'm not sure.
I personally feel very unqualified to answer what form of world government would arise if aliens contacted us tomorrow.
Yeah. Sure. Well, sure. Go on, Chris.
I think that, like, it is, I'm not sure, because the Dispossessed is, you know, so nakedly political.
Right.
This feels, even though politics play a major role, I'm not sure, I don't know if I can make a call about whether she's saying something about the Ecumen or not.
Right.
I do think...
Yeah, I don't know either.
I think Genli represents them relatively well. He's kind of prickly, but he's ultimately a very, like, trying to understand. And
right. Like, he seems like an earnest, genuine person who is just in a situation he doesn't understand.
Yeah, and the fact that he doesn't... correct me if I'm wrong, reflect on the Ecumen, you know, too critically. Like, I think that matters.
It probably does.
The window that we're granted is not, you know, we're not really meant to know, to be able to do too much with that, I guess. I think for me, it's the, definitely the gender and the, or not gender, but sex. The sex in the...
Right. Yeah, come on. You got to know the difference.
Sorry.
Come on, buddy.
Yeah, no, I do know the difference. It just slipped.
But gender is a social construct.
Well, and to some extent, sex is a construct.
Right.
In the Left Hand of Darkness.
And so let's move on to the Gethins being intersex. So you mentioned, Chris, that The Dispossessed is nakedly political. And I actually think that applies to this novel, too, The Left Hand of Darkness. It's just that The Dispossessed... Excuse me. The Dispossessed deals with specific politics that are extremely relevant to here and now, like capitalism versus anarchism. And it's not that this book doesn't do that too, but it seems much more interested in the politics that come about because the people are intersex, right? And so what would you say, what would you say is kind of being examined there or being thought about, basically?
Maybe I'm colored by the start of the conversation, but I think like the nature of dichotomy and how like that that gives some sense of defined roles in a society. There's a part in the novel where Ginley and Estraven are talking about men and women in their different cultures, but also in their different sort of manifestations of sex and in their with their different people, but also how that sort of manifests in culture and in and in politics. And so like, I think there is something to the existence of a sort of fixed duality that creates a kind of dichotomy that creates a distinction and a spectrum or a series of spectrums that, you know, have unfortunate hierarchical baggage and all sorts of shit. So, you know, I don't know if I know what to do with that, but that's what I read in it.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. Well, it seems like even though the dualism of sex that you pointed out, Chris, is also to some extent a construct, given that like people there are certain chromosomal anomalies that can make a person who we would say should turn out to be a man still turns out to be a woman, at least in terms of like genitalia, right? Like, I forget what they're called, but like, you know, an XX person or an XY person can still end up a woman or whatever, a female.
Yes.
So even though the there's not that dualistic distinction, the novel still seems to think that there is some dualism inherent to quote unquote the human condition, for lack of a better term. I mean, that it's in the title, right? The left hand of darkness is light, right? So like, you know, I believe the yin and the yang is also mentioned in the novel. So and maybe that's like interesting in and of itself, the idea that despite the lack of defined sexes for the Gethin people, dualistic qualities of existence still seem to arise. Does that make sense?
Hierarchies definitely arrive. Go ahead, Hans.
Right.
Well, it does make sense, right, to say the point of the novel is that even, well, the point of the novel, that's not good phrasing, right? But if you were to say, like, If you were to extract the thematic idea that hierarchies and binaries and dualism still arise, even in the absence of biological sex, I guess that's a theme, right? There's something about it that feels a little bit underwhelming to me as an idea. I don't know.
That's fair.
I do think that, a great deal of this may be first read thoughts, right? I did find myself surprised ultimately when I thought of this novel ahead of time, I thought of it as the androgyny novel, right?
Right,
and,
sure.
And it was interesting to me, at least, actually, for the most part, how little that registers in the word-to-word, page-to-page reading of the thing, right? Most of the characters basically just, in the mind's eye, in the way that they kind of strike you in casual reading, just kind of come off as just a bunch of dudes, basically.
Right, right. No, and I agree with that. That was something I thought was weird when I read it.
And I don't know. I mean, if I were trying to write a novel, it's tricky, right? Because, how do you write something like this without just constantly dwelling on physical descriptions of the inner sexuality of the characters? How do you not make that kind of tiresome?
Right.
But I do. My instinct is to think that you could go through this book and remove that particular aspect, right? The lack of binary sex, and end up with something where you had 90% or 95% of all the same words almost, and most of the same themes, really. It felt oddly absent as a theme in spite of its being the idea that most people treat as being the hook. But it might be, again, if I were to jump right back into it right now, maybe if I reread the political section, trying to think of it as an expression of a non-gendered politics, maybe I could read it that way, but it doesn't feel like the kind of political machinations of that require everybody to be an androgen, right? I mean, you have, in Carhide, you have this elaborate set of rituals in communication that to me felt very reminiscent of maybe Japanese courts, right? Like medieval Japanese courts.
Sure.
And then in Orgarin, you have an authoritarian bureaucracy, which God knows we have enough of those, right? An authoritarian bureaucracy, which appears on the surface to be a calm, prosperous society, which is a very common social type. So yeah, I don't know. I don't, I mean, it seems like even maybe more time was spent on the idea of humans that periodically go into heat, which doesn't require them to be androgynous, right? It's actually how almost all mammals other than humans work, right?
So other than humans work, yeah.
So that was more present as a plot point and as kind of a device, but that doesn't require the androgyny theme automatically. So, yeah, I don't know. If there's anything that I guess I would be critical of the novel about, it's that that is somehow both central and peripheral in an odd way that you could see as a feature or a bug, I suppose.
I don't know whether it's a feature or a bug, but I think I have this exact experience of this novel, not quite understanding how the race of androgynous people interacts with everything else. The idea of dualism is certainly not I don't want to say dualism originally started as X, but one form of dualism might be Plato's forms, where you have the Platonic ideal that exists in abstract and then the real example of that thing, right? That might be a kind of dualism. So there certainly seems like there's that dualism separate from biological sex is like at least a reality in that we have that idea. And then, so it doesn't quite mesh to me. And this is on a second read. This is on a second read thinking that the androgyny of the people doesn't seem as central, like you said, Hans. Whereas, like, you definitely could not write The Dispossessed, which I know you haven't read, Hans.
I've read The Dispossessed.
You've read it?
Yeah.
Or you've heard of it?
No, I've read it.
Oh, okay. So you couldn't write that with the moon being capitalist as well as the planet. Like, you have to have that central theme of anarchism versus capitalism for that novel to work. Whereas, in this novel,
that book is inconceivable without it.
Right, exactly. And so it's a strange difference with this novel, where we could take away this androgynous stuff and still kind of come out with a novel that resembles it to a great degree.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I mean, I don't.
Yeah.
I almost wonder if, you know, I was very, very complimentary of this novel at the beginning. I do suppose that you could argue that that's a pretty significant flaw in an objective sense, right? That one of the core ideas is not developed in a way that makes it, maybe the distinguishing idea, right, is not developed in a way that makes it feel like it needs to be there. Even though, you know, if you think about, like, why do we revere Le Guin? It's because of ideas like that, right? But you could do a light edit and call it Travel Across the Snow Planet and just get rid of the androgyny and the heat and have, like, almost the same novel, right? So, I think that I went into this with a kind of reverence, right? Maybe an extra level of reverence because it is, because of the kind of stigma around sci-fi that you talked about, right? Where I was like, this is top-notch shit and I'm going to take it seriously and revere it.
Right.
Maybe was even, like, less critical in thinking of it than I would have been with something literary where I didn't feel like I was compensating for a bias. I mean, assuming, you know, the idea that literary isn't treating that as a genre rather than a value statement.
Right. Okay. All right. Does, you know, anybody want to add anything else before we say, see you next time, listeners?
I think of those who walk away from Omelas probably once a week. It's one of the most important, like, sort of, I don't know, structures of storytelling of meaning.
That, like, the thought experiment storytelling?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. It's really important to me.
I get it. I think about the ones who walk away from Omelas a lot too.
I don't think about Le Guin's novels as much though. Some of her short work. I do love The Dispossessed, and if you choose it, I'll happily read it. Sorry, I didn't mean to fuck you, but
no, it's not your
good
fault.
Book. Good pick, it's not, Patrick.
I'm glad we read this.
Yeah.
Having read The Dispossessed and having not read this, like, I was more glad to expand my experience with Le Guin than I would have been to go back through. Because I only read The Dispossessed a couple of years ago. It's relatively recent.
Right. Okay. Happy Accident, which is a great movie. I really love that movie. Happy Accidents.
I have a question, and you can, maybe this is an edit point.
Yeah.
Maybe this isn't relevant. I had a memory of you doing The Dispossessed, like, in the early podcast days before we were consistent with this three-piece. Am I remembering that right? Have you actually, like, done that on, like, way back in, you know, first 10 episodes?
I don't think so.
I swear you did some liquid.
I swear that I do. Patrick, you and I didn't talk about The Dispossessed at some point?
I don't think so. Like, I'm totally having a blank on that if we did.
I don't know.
I mean, maybe.
I don't know how I'd find out, but.
Well, if it's on audio, if it's on our podcast provider service, we could check it out. I don't know.
Yeah, we did it. February 16th, 2019.
When did we do it?
February 16th, 2019.
All of us?
No. I don't think Hans was on the pod then.
Audio boom. This is insane to me. Like, oh my God, my brain. Something's wrong with my brain.
Patrick, be kind to yourself. My brain is so fucked. I'm so fucked. Oh, just God. Minute by minute, I'm so fucked, man.
Oh my God, my brain. What happened to my brain? How can I not remember doing that? All right. Well, that's okay. Well, if we've already done it, we don't need to do it again. Okay.
I forgot too until Hans brought it up. So don't worry.
Yeah, that's crazy to me.
Hans remembered something that he didn't even
that
fucking
he didn't even fucking do. He
See,
just
Hans,
was like,
that's why you should never have kids because they fuck your brain. Your brain is fucked irrevocably after that.
I feel like my brain is kind of fucked already.
Because of the drugs.
How dare you, Hans? How dare
you?
Yeah,
yeah. How dare I fuck
you? I understand. Yeah. Okay, so cool. Great conversation as usual. It's awesome. You know, I appreciate you guys talking to me and sitting through my monologue. Chris, what are we going to read next?
I said I might do it. I'm going to do it. If you guys haven't watched Mad God yet, I'm going to ask you to. And if I do want to put it out there, it is genuinely unpleasant. if that is not like, if you're not feeling up to it, it is a grotesque at times movie.
But I can handle it.
I think it deserves to be talked about. I have some questions already for it. Is this art? It feels in this time of AI that the incredible intentional detail in this work may never again be repeated in a visual medium. What factors go into encouraging or discouraging the creation of works like this one that have so much detail? Should we be, and maybe awfulness, should works like this be encouraged? And, you know, then I have some questions about the movie itself. But does that sound okay, you guys? Like, it's I really am serious. If you're not feeling up to watching something that can be really upsetting, that's totally understandable.
Being upset and disturbed is my favorite. The favorite thing I get out of reading books and watching movies.
I'm doing this for you, Patrick. I really thought of you more than anyone in my life when I watched this movie. And Hans, are you like?
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm
to
totally
it?
Fine. Yeah, yeah. No, okay. I can handle it. Yeah, no. For sure. I'll wait till the night. I'm in a good mood. You know, surely one of those will arise in the next couple of weeks. But it's. It's kind of it's a little bit of a relief because I've got kind of a backlog of books right now. So I was hoping you would pick something that would not take a bunch of reading time so I could work through some of that. So that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's pretty dense, but pretty dense and, like I said, pretty unpleasant at times. Or maybe you come to the end of it like me and you're like, God, I really want to watch that again, and then immediately watch it again. I don't know. And maybe you could tell me that there's maybe something fucking wrong with me after you watch it, but I'm really interested to talk about it. I think it deserves to be talked about. And I'm genuinely like it came out in 2022, the same like year, I believe, that GPT or a year before GPT 3.5 blew everyone's socks off. And I don't like, it took 30 years to make it. And this guy fucking handmade everything in it. And I just don't know. It almost feels sad to me that this, may be the high point of something like that. But, anyway, really interested in talking about it with you guys.
All right. All right, listeners, this has been our discussion of The Left Hand of Darkness, a.k.a. The Left Hand of Fartness by Ursula K. Le Guin. Next time, we are going to be talking about Mad God, a disturbing, disturbing film. Peace out.